Every house has a story to tell, from how and when it was built to the lives of the people who lived there through the years. If your walls could talk, what would they say? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert.
Sister's saying in her sleep, brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around.
Every person who lives in a home leaves their mark on it in one way or another. Walls might not talk, but if you know how to look, your house will share its stories. And learning the rich history about your home can be extremely rewarding. We invite you to join in this discussion today by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email questions and comments to ideas@wpr.org. Vicki Ruth Hahn is a retired librarian and the founder of Stateline Genealogy Club. Vicki is a stateline genealogy sorter with a background in anthropology, history, research, and reference. In her work, she sorts out mysteries, weaves stories, and helps people to learn how to do their own research and discover the history of their homes. Vicki, welcome to Route 51.
Hello, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you, too. I'm curious, what are some of the biggest reasons that people have for taking on this kind of research and finding out the history of their homes?
Well, there's a variety of things. They may want to have an older home be placed on the National Registry of Historic Places and understand more how to preserve the style of it if it's quite an older home. They may need to prove legal ownership by finding the records or find out what the value of it is. And they may be just curious about the house or the people who lived in it. I've had people that came to the library when I worked there asking about a house at a particular address. And as we continued the reference questioning, found out that they wanted to know who had died there because it was haunted.
Oh, really?
So, that's one thing that can be interesting about it. And I look at looking at genealogy of houses in a general way, not just a house that your family's lived in forever, but where have your people lived in different houses. So I have a more general approach to it. They also want to know the history of the house and maybe the local history, how it fits into the area, the town, the community that it's in. They may have had that house in the family for years and years and years and want to find out more about the history of when their people first moved there or what has been done to it to remodel it since. And like I said, you know, it may be haunted.
It may be haunted. So where do we begin? I mean, does it all begin with establishing a chain of title, and how do you do that?
Well, the title is one of the most important proofs that you can have to show ownership in the chain of that. In an 1839 house that I owned for several years in Roscoe, Illinois, the title was actually left with the house, and a lot of it was handwritten, and it showed all the different owners, and there was actually quite a turnover. And I had found out that the very first owner of it was Amos Tuttle, who had helped found Roscoe, and apparently he had bought it and built several homes in that area as an investment. I don't know if he ever actually lived there because it was such a short time. And that was the second house built in Roscoe.
So interesting. But I mean, let's say we don't have the benefit of having those written records there. Where do we start? Property deeds and plat maps? Where do we go?
Right. Well, and the title is available usually at the county.
Okay.
That the houses at.
Online usually, or do you have to go to
You can see it online, and you can get a lot of information from there for free. You can ask them to copy it for a charge and send it to you. Mm-hmm. You can go in to the county courthouse and look it up yourself for free, and usually they'll charge you to copy it again.
Sure.
Or you can just write it down. And actually, that title I donated to the local history room at the North Suburban Library there in Roscoe. So look at your local history rooms at libraries, go to your academic libraries nearby, go to historical societies nearby. They may or may not have something of that nature, but they might have other things available. And in the case when people would come in looking for a particular address, I would direct them immediately to the city directories.
Okay.
And that is a crisscross directory. It has a city usually listed by a person's name, a person's address, and a person's phone number once phone numbers became available. And the earlier ones didn't have that, of course. Mm-hmm. And then they refer to each one. So if you know any piece of that information, you can find out more, and you follow along in the city directories that come out every year. And it says who lived at a particular place, what their job was, where they worked, how old they were sometimes, whether they were a widow or not. And it was from high school age up, and that household was listed.
Wow, that's a lot of information.
It's a lot of information. I love city directories. But not every community has them. Small towns may or may not, and usually they are included in a big city directory nearby. For instance, South Beloit, Illinois' city directory is included in Beloit, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
And some small towns don't even have city directories. So then you go to the library or the historical society in the county or the city or the town, rather, and look for old phone books. And you can do the same thing but not get as much information.
Okay. What kind of clues can we get from the style of a home? How much does the style of our home tell us about its age and maybe even who built it in the first place?
Quite a lot. Sometimes on the title or the deed, which is also the title, or the property taxes, which is also something you can get through your city or county, it will list the ownership. It will list the room sizes and the architectural type and how old a house may be. And just on the property tax, it may say 1900 for an older house, but it's maybe older than that because they just use that as a kind of a giveaway age if they don't know. And looking actually at the physical building itself, the house or our building in general, you can tell a lot from the architecture. There's different types of architecture that were available and popular being built at certain times in history. Like right now, we're all about ranch and, you know, mm-hmm. tri-levels and the bigger, fancier mini mansions, you know, mm-hmm. McDonald's mansions and that. And so those we're all familiar with. But there's a lot of historical different types of buildings. Talking about the 1839 house I had in Roscoe, it was a Greek Revival, which was very popular then. There were several other houses in the area that I could compare information about to see that. But literally it was built out of brick, and double thick brick actually, and the upper windows were smaller. They were very narrow, kind of rectangular, and the one thing about those houses, especially the ones they were almost all of brick, was that there was a rod that went through the upper second floor from one side, like from the front of the building to the back of the house, and there was like braces on each end that held, it literally held the top floor together.
Oh.
And my house, those had been painted over. So you have to look. But
was that unusual for the type of house that you had? Or was that a clue that told you that this was?
That was a clue.
Okay.
That was very standard, yes. And the other thing was it was quite typical at that time not to have closets or as many windows because those cost more for being taxed.
Mm.
They'd be considered another room.
That's why.
And yes.
Oh,
and
wow.
And then also that house and several other houses back then would have a separate kitchen building mm-hmm. right next to the house to keep it cool in the summer and also to reduce the amount of burning of the house down possibilities, you know, to keep it safer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was linked up together at one point, all became one house. And then also at one point, that house would have had an outside basement entrance, and it was a dirt floor. And then later they added cement, and it had a log across the basement as a support beam, and it still had the bark on it. So
interesting. What about the fixtures and design elements? I mean, some of the you know, the moldings, can that give us some important
right.
clues as well?
Sure. Well, and it can go down to even the electrical or the plumbing if they haven't been remodeled out, or even some furniture that was original to the house. Some of the lighting fixtures may give you clues. There's books and online you can look to see, like Pinterest even has stuff on there.
Sure.
To show what age different things were popular in. For instance, a house that my sister bought, and it was a 1905 house. When she took down the ceiling, she saw there was a fixture up there that included gas for lighting, mm-hmm. for a gas fixture, and electric all in one.
Oh.
So it was transitioning. And, for instance, the house that I grew up on a farm till I was seven, it was, I believe they call them a four-square
mm-hmm.
farmhouse. And essentially it's four rooms downstairs, four rooms upstairs, rather big, probably 250,000 square feet at least. A huge porch across the whole front of the house that was covered. And you went in and there was pocket doors in there. There was a lot of wood trim all around the house, a lot of built-ins. There was a built-in pass-through between the kitchen and the dining room that had a pantry built, or had a cupboards built around it, but then it was a pass-through from the kitchen in there so you could pass your food through, and there was a pantry built in there. And then downstairs was actually milk processing room for the fresh milk that they would, you know, milk the cows and mm-hmm. process it in a cream and separate it, and a coal bin room. And a workbench. And the bedrooms were on the second floor. There was only one bathroom, which was actually an advancement for a 1918 house.
Oh, sure.
And you want to look and see, is there an original fireplace in here? Or maybe did they just use a coal-burning stove instead?
Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated with hidden cupboards and passageways. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Have been found.
Yeah. What are some clues to look for that you might have one in your house?
Well, one clue, when you're looking at the architecture, you can see if a brick home or even a wood home, if there's something that's been blocked in, like covered up, like the outside entryway to the basement was blocked in with newer bricks or blocks, and another staircase was added on later. And you can look for like the crawl spaces, and that might leave something. If you have a hidden room or a hidden closet, something, you may feel a draft in a weird place and come to find out that it's been kind of sealed up later. Some more common things that you can run into are like, if you have in the basement some old shelves, they may have lining on them that's some old newspapers that'll give you clues to when that house was built or remodeled. There may be insulation in the walls that's old newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
There may be markings, writings, notes from workmen that worked on it or built it. One time somebody came into the library with a souvenir plate that was used to build the Beloit Public Library. It was used as a fundraiser for the Andrew Carnegie Building because in 1902, because he always required the community to participate. And a woman had found this little 5-inch souvenir plate up in her attic, which means somebody from 1905 or 1902, 1903 had bought that plate.
Wow.
So that's probably when the house was built. And interestingly enough, right next to it was what she assumed was a workman's wallet that had been left there. But as soon as she touched the wallet, it disintegrated. It was so old.
Oh.
But what clues it would have had.
Yes. And some of this stuff inside the walls, you know, that if you're doing any remodeling, it's so interesting to see the newspapers. And my husband bought his first house he ever bought. He was doing a bunch of remodeling, and he found a bunch of old liquor bottles in the walls.
Oh,
like, I don't know. It's so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know what that says about the house or the builders.
It might have been a Prohibition era house.
It might have indeed. Vicki Ruth Hahn is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on finding the history of your home. Ahead, some tools you can use to get started on your own, and we'll answer your questions too when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue now with our discussion on home genealogy with Vicki Ruth Hahn. Your comments and questions are welcome. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or call 800-780-9742. Vicki, can some of the same tools we use for personal genealogy research, like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, those kinds of things, are they also helpful in this kind of research?
Yes, they are. The Ancestry.com, in conjunction with a home especially, but individually, is instead of just searching for a person's name, and sometimes you have the name to begin with and sometimes you don't, like we've already discussed, is to go in the catalog part of it. There's a tab for research, and go drill down to the actual town and sometimes even at least the county. And even sometimes the smaller communities within a town, city, and you can see a list of all the sources that they have available. For instance, map atlases, county histories, stories about somebody's biography that lived in that town. And so that's very useful to look at it. And then it lists, you can sort it by the year that it was published. You can include names or not names. That's one of the best backdoor ways to use Ancestry for searching homes. And houses, I look at also as, like I said, they really are part of a community. And so research the history of the community as well. The prehistory, back to the Indians, all those crazy roads we travel, especially in Wisconsin, are based on Indian trails, mm-hmm. and there's maps on those. Another favorite one I use is FamilySearch.org, and that is free. Ancestry.com and Heritage Quest are both ones you can get at most libraries in-house anyway. FamilySearch.org, unless you have a subscription to those other ones, you can get it home for free. And the cool thing about that is what's called a wiki, W-I-K-I, and that's, again, a research tab. And it literally will take you to any country, any state, and a lot of counties. And, for instance, it will list any genealogy words in a foreign language that you need to know to translate basically the search of vital records. It will show you which maps there are. It will talk about the history of that state or that city. And then, again, listing different sources that they have. So those are some real basic ones.
There's so much information, from graves to even yearbook photos. I found my own yearbook photo on Ancestry.com. It's almost unnerving, isn't it?
Yes, it's exactly. It's sort of like the dichotomy of genealogists. It's like we want as much information as we can find about anybody and everything and every house, but then there's the privacy thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. How about newspapers.com? Have you used that at all? Has that been helpful?
Yes, I have found the old newspapers, and usually that's something that you have to pay a subscription for. Sometimes the libraries will have access to some of the local newspapers, either on microfilm or digitally for free, and with your library card. But if you have a subscription to it, I found some really interesting things previously in newspapers. Talk about sort of privacy. They would list so-and-so's son and daughter-in-law came to visit with their two children. They live in California, but they were visiting in Elkhorn, Wisconsin for a few days to visit with their family, and then all the people's names are listed, and then there'd be a photograph. And I found a connection to a person I was looking at for this community through that. And it was like, oh, they do have children. And this is where they live now, but they did live here, and their parents still live here. And, you know, so there's a lot of indirect clues like that you can access and find.
I didn't even think about that. There are some of those little small town newspapers that have done that even in recent years. The Marion Advertiser, right, for example, you know, it still has the column about who came and who came to visit.
Well, and you know what we do now? We go on Facebook. Look on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Look up your people. There's a lot of genealogical information in there, including anniversaries and birthdays and when they moved and where they moved and what they're working at now and who they're related to. And so,
what about census data?
Census is a key. And it's not just the United States federal censuses you want to look at. Those come out every 10 years. From 1790, and the latest one you can access right now is 1950 because of the 72-year privacy rule. But those are all available. And also there are state censuses in a lot of the states that would come out in the intervening, like 1905 versus 1910. And there's also, there are like farm censuses, business censuses, mortality censuses, Indian registry censuses. So once you've got a person's name, you can actually go there. And I'm not going to explain it because it's a little quirky how to do it, but okay, you can actually go into Ancestry.com and kind of do a reverse search to get the address and see who lived there if you don't know the people.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's not real 100%, but I've done it a couple of times.
Oh, okay. Okay. And the census data, you can just get that online? I mean, it's...
Well, there's several different sources, yes. There's Ancestry.com and FamilySearch.org both have the census records, and you can go through the, I believe it's NARA, the National Archives. It's not through the census part. It'll tell you. It will actually. And the other thing about census is, look at the rules for when the enumerators, which are the people that went to go look for those questions each 10 years, what did they ask for each census, and when was the date that they were supposed to refer to as far as when this date happened, what was going on in your family, even if it's different today, 6 months later. And then it was not until 1890 that the census included the street name and address, the house numbers. In the cities, it even would include the apartment numbers. But some smaller towns would just put the street name or sloppy enumerators. You know, they didn't want to bother writing it down or something. So
I have a question about, and this might be, this might sound a little dumb, but I mean, if you find out that your house is really old and has some historic value, how do you find out if it qualifies for like landmark status, or what's the process? Do you know?
Well, yes, I do. And actually, just before I forget, there is a list of the Wisconsin historic houses at WisconsinHistoricalSociety.org. But you go to the National Register of Historic Places program. And that is a national government site. You look for the .gov, that means national government, and you can go through a process to register your house. There's also another source, which is Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation with his guides. And then in certain cities, they will have in the library there and sometimes online what they call survey reports. Architectural and historical survey reports about the older homes in the area that have been preserved, and then they'll give clues about how to go about it. And there's rules when you remodel a house that's gone on preservation about what you can, you know, what you can add to it and what you can't, and down to like what your door on your garage can look like, you know, what your lights outside can look like.
Sure. So there's rules involved then.
So there's good and bad about it, but there's resources. And you don't have to remember all these things. I on my statelinegenealogy.wordpress.com blog, I have a tab that is links and helps, and it lists pages and pages and pages of all these sources and resources and links to mostly free helps and of these databases and all these different government sites. And it's alphabetically by topic. So
we're talking with Vicki Ruth Hahn about researching the history of your home, and there's plenty of time for you to call in with your questions. 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. Is the research process different for ancestral homes, finding the history of a family's home in another country, for example? How difficult is it?
It is a little more difficult because you're farther away unless you do a heritage trip, and you need to set things up ahead of time because here in the United States and in other countries, for example, some of the records that you need may be kept in somebody's home that works as a record keeper there officially, or you can go online to different Facebook sites for like a city or a town or a village in Ireland and see the history of it. And there's resources there that show what kind of vital records are available, titles and, you know, county, their county histories and that kind of thing. And you can actually link up with somebody and say, hey, could somebody do me a genealogical favor? And I think you're my third cousin or my fifth cousin or something. We have the same name from the same city that I found my people are from. Would you be willing to either do for pay or for free, you know, look at this site for me and send me the information? And I'd love to know if there's anything you have because, you know, sometimes they've had long genealogy. You don't know who in your family has done the genealogy. I know somebody from with Swedish connections, some fifth cousin or something, sent her a whole lot of photographs of her great-grandparents that she never had.
Ooh, that's fascinating. I know some of those sites like Ancestry.com also have additional tiers that will go to the overseas stuff that you pay an extra fee and then you can find out more from
right.
Yeah.
But international version, it's about $100 more.
Yeah, it's a little spendy. I know that. Yeah. I know it's available, but it sounds like there are some free ways
and
to do it too.
That part's not available through the library, but these databases have sales, especially during the holidays, so be looking for that. And some people, as a way to manage the cost of doing this, will have a membership for a while, 6 months or say, and then go off of it for a while and continue doing the research and then go back on as a new member and get a new member discount.
That's a good idea, too. How common is it for a home to have been previously used for another purpose? And I'm asking this because a friend of mine was absolutely shocked to learn that the house that she bought had formerly been a funeral home. It was a long time ago.
Oh,
but she had no idea.
Sure. And then your title will tell you that and your city directories, too. It's like, that address was what?
Have you come across that kind of thing a lot?
I have. The house in Roscoe, again, 1839, it was, and this was from talking with neighbors and looking in the local history and even looking on Zillow.com, which is a real estate agent. You know, they'll have records of different things and sometimes tell the history that's been passed down to them, and you can see different connections. But, for instance, the house that was built in 1839 had been one of the early meeting places for the Roscoe United Methodist Church when it was still the circuit riders, you know, coming through and stopping at different places. It had been a button shop and maybe a post office at one time. And I found that from the neighbor, there was a stagecoach road between our two houses and then went across the front of my house and then on. There used to be stagecoaches from Chicago, which was smaller than Beloit, Wisconsin at the time, to Galena, which was bigger than Chicago also. And then later there was another one in the 1850s that was from like south of Rockford up to Milwaukee through Roscoe. And so the house on the corner just next to me was one of the stagecoach inns. So that person found that history of that.
Oh, wow.
And then on Zillow, I got the clue. Also, I would just put it all together. There was another house about 5 miles away that was one of the original stagecoach runs too, but that house was the same age as mine. And so I know it was the earlier stagecoach run.
Mm, that's so That's fascinating.
I know. You just keep asking and keep looking, and it's just amazing.
And then imagine what happened there and the people who were there.
Sure. Mm. Well, and one of the families I researched in Troy and East Troy, Wisconsin, in Walworth County, the Graydon family, one of the streets on the other side of his house was named Graydon, so he started that subdivision. And come to find out that the ice house he had owned and retired from nearby got taken over by Al Capone. And it was used as a beer distribution site for years before they got shut down by all the governments together ganging up on him and saying, hey, you can't do this anymore. But Al Capone literally walked the square in East Troy, went into the barber shop, got his hair cut. Can you imagine?
No.
Being the barber with that straight edge razor and the goons standing there with their looking at you with their guns underneath their coat.
Oh my gosh.
And the son of this man and his mom had moved to another house nearby on the other side of the square, but he had a grocery store. And so you know that he had associations with Al Capone coming and say, hey, kid, I knew your dad. How about you give me a deal? You know, so it's like not just the history of the house, but
well, kind of the social histories of the people, you know, around. It seems to be the most interesting part. Is it for you?
Fun. I've researched a couple of different families like that literally don't have many relatives left or any. And it's like you find out, like, it was just like given to me, like these beautiful gifts of interesting history that they had connections with. I mean, I have a lot of programs on all these different things I've learned. So
I love how you put that, the gift. You know, it feels like a gift, learning these nuggets of information. Vicki Ruth Hahn is our guest today on Route 51, a look at how to research the history of your home. Ahead, we'll hear about some of the more interesting facts our guest has uncovered in her research. We'll answer your questions, too, when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I got a yard, it's full of wildflowers, 'cause I'm a wild child, yeah, I got my own style. I got a rooftop view that don't stop, got my name on the deed in the mailbox. I sleep easy in the bed I made, and I dream bigger than I did before. Took a while to feel this way, brick by brick, board by board.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guest, Vicki Ruth Hahn, as we continue our discussion on home genealogy. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Vicki, how did you get into this in the first place?
Well, I have a lot of people in my family that love history. My mother and my paternal grandmother especially, and they would share with us from when we were very young the history of our family, the history of our houses that we lived in, the history of the area, and research more, and libraries are a big part of our life. We'd go on a regular basis. I'd always wanted to be a detective and a writer and help people, and so being a genealogist and a librarian fulfilled all those things. When I was at the library, they knew that I had a bachelor's degree in history or anthropology with a history minor. And I also took quite a few classes, home economic classes, believe it or not. I didn't have time to take in high school, but I took a lot of classes on architecture and interior design and the history of clothing. And so knowing that, they said, would you start a genealogy club at the library? And then it was like, and that was 2012, and then it was like 2014, all right, we want you to do a blog. So it's become my business once I retired, and I just love giving programs on all these different aspects of genealogy and, you know, architecture and Well, all the different things.
Genealogy has really become a passion of a lot of people lately. I feel like it's just exploded in popularity. What do you think that's all about? What do you think people have this thirst to know more about their history?
Well, and I don't know if it's been proven, but I've heard that is the second most popular hobby in the United States until the summer than gardening is. So, but it's a never-ending hobby. It's totally interesting, the things you find, the connections. You know, the part of what spurred me to get involved was stories that I heard from my mom and grandmother again and other people about, hey, you are related to the king of the Franks, which was Germany later. You have a great-grandmother from Paris, France. You have a great-grandfather that was a Welsh miner that moved to Pennsylvania. You know, just it's just like the surprises you find as you go along the way.
And the connections.
And the connections. And then my brother did some genealogy on the Muir family, M-U-I-R, or Moore, so he could prove to be a clan leader in Alaska of a clan. He didn't know. He knew we had several Irish and Scottish mm-hmm. ancestors. And then I found out that one of our relatives, the Muir relatives, had written a book about the Muir clan, and that we have a castle in Scotland.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So that was kind of fun to, you know, just all the different surprises, good and bad. You know, there's sometimes skeletons in a family, and at the time, the family doesn't want anybody to know, but here we are, you know, 3-4 generations later, it's like, oh, that's interesting. Tell me more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine who researched her house told me that the biggest lesson she learned was to check her preconceived notions at the door. In her case, a recorded year didn't make sense because the house's style was totally different. It didn't match. How skeptical do we need to be in the beginning?
Well, I always say you need to prove it 3 different ways at least. And it can be tedious, and you have to keep track as you're doing your research. A research log is a good idea. Either just writing it down on a paper, doing an Excel spreadsheet, Word document, or a software that you can have just on your computer that you don't share across the internet, and keep track of where you looked and what you found, and then look at the dates and the names and say, is it possible? Number one, was this thing invented back then when they were saying that they had it or they were doing it? Was this church built when your great-grandparents got married in it in Lincolnshire, England, and moved the next day sailing to America? Mm-hmm. You know, where did they leave from the port? You have to research all around it, and sometimes you have to come back to it. You're not going to find it all laid out from their birth to their death or from the beginning of the house when it was built to current day. You'll find different clues about it throughout and keep track of it by the year, so you can compare things, and then even somebody with the same name in the same place may be a completely different person.
Right. And I mean, sometimes it can be really complicated. You go down one rabbit hole after another. Right. I mean, I know I took a few wrong turns myself when I was researching my own family history. Do you have a good system for keeping track of it all? And what do you suggest?
Well, and I'm still learning and figuring out how I want to do it. Even naming my files that I keep, it's a good idea to scan your photographs of things and keep them digitally. And then, but naming the files, so they're not too long, but they're still descriptive. But then they've got, you know, there's different ways to do it with metadata. And there's just so many different helps and devices and apps out there that I'm always constantly kind of trying to find a way to get through them. And it's like, I know enough technology to get in trouble, but I don't really like doing it, but it's a necessary tool to be able to get what I want. So I have Ancestry.com. I have MyHeritage that I've subscribed to. I've subscribed to Find My Past, which is more European, England related, strong, and they keep adding to their collections, all of them, any of them. Mm-hmm. And then I have softwares and I have all kinds of apps, and I kind of analyze them and figure them out, and I put them on my Facebook page for State Line Genealogy Club or on my blog to help other people. But My favorite one that I found is doing research questions. And so you can write up a question and say, what am I looking for about this person or this house? What do I know already? Where am I going to look for more clues? What have I found out when I looked there? Does this still lead me to conclude that this fact is true that I'm thinking was my presumption or my family story or the what somebody told me about this house? And then you can prove it or disprove it. And sometimes, and then if you get tired of that one or you get to a stump, you know, a brick wall, you can just leave it and it's all in writing. You go back and look at a different part of the family or a different house and work on that for a while and then go back and you'll know exactly where you ended up.
Have you ever had people who became superstitious thinking that the house may be haunted if it has some troubling history that they discover?
Yes, and I have a few friends that are actually psychic. They are sensitive to paranormal things, and they have shared things with me, and I'm skeptical about that whole thing, but I know them, I respect them, I know they're telling their truth, and there's something there. So if you are curious about whether your house is haunted, either from the history or sensing it, you might want to bring in a friend that is sensitive and have a, I actually have a posting about that, about is it easier for somebody that's paranormally sensitive to do genealogy because they can ask grandpa the questions directly even after he's died, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I talk to my friends and I said, I'm going to be talking about some of these things and quoting you some of the things you've shared with me. Is that okay? And they thought it was funny and fine because it's, you know, that's what they do. But also there's different paranormal investigation groups
sure.
that will investigate your house for a fee. And most public places, like, for instance, the Beloit Senior Center, they'll pay them to do it, and they want to publicize it and have a big party and tell about the results they found out. But a personal home, you don't really want to share that
mm-hmm.
because it may affect your value of your house. It may make people feel a little weird. I mean, I know about a house that several owners, I knew the owners, and they all say it's haunted, but it's like, I'm not going to really share that.
Right.
And when these paranormal societies do investigate places, they won't give the address unless it's a public place.
Okay.
They will say, like, near the corner of such and so street and such and so avenue in this city.
Sure, sure.
I
love the stories that you've shared about, like the Al Capone story. And I mean, what are some of the other interesting things that you've uncovered?
Well, one of the houses that my family moved to when they moved up to the Rockford area after they moved off the farm was a big 3-story home with big enclosed porches on upper and lower, and you know it was huge. And it was moved 2 miles on the street from what was then North Park, Illinois. It had been on the Gold Coast, what they called the Gold Coast, which is the rich houses, mm-hmm. on the river. Moved 2 miles down the street. They had to lift up the overhead lines. And they moved it to not the Gold Coast, farther down in North Park, a block or so from the river, and turned it into a duplex and rented it out. And then we turned it back into one family home. So houses move, buildings mm-hmm. move. They've been moved across the ice on the Rock River in Beloit. The names change. One of the houses that I did not research, but I know the person that did, Teresa, it's about a house. It's called A Very Modest Cottage. It's the book that she wrote about that research, Teresa Surratt, S-U-R-R-A-T-T. And it was just a very small building house down in near Quincy, Illinois, and which is actually kind of where my farm that I'd lived on had been close to that. And she researched the house. She did all the local history, library, talking to the neighbors, looking in the court records, the whole thing, and found out that it had been a house, a used car lot, headquarters office building. It had been a hangout for a gang. It had been a prostitute hangout.
Wow. Quite the colorful history.
Yes. And in storage for firewood. And then she found it, researched, her grandmother lived down there, and she decided she wanted it for her, she wanted it on her property. Mm-hmm. And she had her brother move it on a trailer. It was small enough to do that, like 200 miles to bring it here. So not only being moved, but all the different purposes it had been. And it had actually been moved out once while it was still down near the Quincy area. It had moved like across the street or something like that. So
we forget that houses move. I mean, they are moved from time to time, and I think that was more common in the past. The Guardian had a great piece on researching a home's history, and they recommend a collaborative approach. And you touched on this a little bit earlier, like calling overseas and saying, hey, but they're saying, talk to the people in the local pub, the neighbors, the local history clubs. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that collaborative approach?
Well, one of the houses that I was studying in the East Troy area, I was trying to figure out if it was that particular house that the great and son had moved to, or one next to it one way or the other, because on one side there was a house or two that had been knocked down. On the other side, it was across the street, you know, next to it. And the street name had been changed like 3 times, 4 times at least. And in the census records, they had not put down the house number. They put a number for that household, but not the house street address number. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to figure out, I knew it had to be, you know, one of those two houses. So I looked on the census records to compare through the years to see who the neighbors were. It didn't actually have the house numbers again, but I was trying to see if there was some consistency, if I could see who had been there before, and if I maybe gotten the title of that house, then I would be able to compare it that way. But I talked to the people at church. I talked to the people that lived in that community, and I said, hey, tell me about this house. Oh, well, that's where the twins,
sure,
Floyd and Boyd, lived. And I found Floyd and Boyd on the census records. So
talking to the people in the neighborhood really helped in this case.
Especially older people. The same with genealogy of your family or individuals. Start with the oldest people first before they're gone and ask them.
Sure. And, you know, I have to think that social media has really contributed to making this a little bit easier, that you can get out there and get a little bit more information. Is that the case?
It is, but sometimes it's a lot of static you have to get through to get to somebody that really knows something. For instance, there's different cities, Rockford, Illinois, and Beloit, Wisconsin, that have, you know, Beloit Remember When, or, you know you're from Beloit because, or whatever. They have different names, and you go on there, and they'll talk about different historical topics, or do you remember when this bar was here and then it got mm-hmm. moved and got renamed, and do you know where so-and-so lived at this time?
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a lot of opinions, and then usually if you look at all the different comments, you can see kind of a consistency of pattern of several people
mm-hmm.
remember a particular fact or name. It's probably true.
Okay.
But you have a lot of guessing in there, too.
Sure, there is. Our last 15 seconds together, just tell me that website of yours that people can go to get a way to start.
Sure. StatelineGenealogyClub.wordpress.com.
Vicki, I want to thank you so much. This has been an absolutely fascinating discussion, and we loved having you.
Thank you very much. I love being here.
This is Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guest, Vicki Ruth Hahn. Our producers are Joy Ratch Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Madness, Daughtry, Cassidy Pope, and Blake Shelton. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at WPR.org/Route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@WPR.org. We would love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. And we'll be sure to list some of the resources we discussed today alongside this program online at WPR.org/Route51. Until next week, we are headed out of town.
There's a house that's a little run down. This city ain't never found.
It's miles and miles from a paved road. That's where we grew up. Seven children raised on love. When life gets hard, that's where we go. Daddy don't know a stranger. A handshake and he's your friend. Oh, and mama, she's an angel. She holds you tight till the heartache ends. Just a place made of nails and wood. But it's the love that makes you feel so good.